evolution. It's a kind of a fat cucumber in space. Now, if that fat cucumber in space that's around your dipole, that's its effective area when it's transmitting or receiving, if you've got highly conductive materials or very lossing materials that are inside of that cucumber, you're going to suffer some disadvantage. In the case of conductive materials, you're going to suffer a little bit of detuning. Not serious. Your antenna tuner or readjusting a lens can take care of it. If there are lossy materials, like a nice sappy tree or a building that's made out of lossy materials, and the lossy materials are inside of the area of that dipole, that swept area of that cucumber, and you can easily calculate this. You can therefore calculate the, by, what would you call it now? Conservation of energy. If I'm lighting up lossy materials in my apartment building, because I got a vertical dipole lying vertical, flat with the face of the apartment building, and inside of the apartment building are materials that at that radio frequency represent a loss, represent a dummy load, you and I can do some rough back of the envelope calculations as to how much you're going to lose. That's what I think is going on. And the tip of the dipole being near ground, the ground itself is a lossy material. And how you get away with that when it's a half-wave dipole, let me drop, and you're connecting it to the balcony of your apartment building, the metal rail, because it's up in the air and there are no local materials that are lossy, allows you to get away with murder. That's a guess on my part. Mel's going to add some more to this. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. This is K2KEY. First of all, this dipole is not connected to the tower. The tower is 85 feet tall. That's in the back. The reason I stay away from that, because I've got all those guy wires and all that aluminum and everything up there. This is, the support is a pine tree, a spruce. And the support, I could say, what was holding this thing, where it was held up there, is off a piece of bamboo that comes off that was supported up there. So I was away from everything metallic with this dipole. As far as you say raising it up further so that the bottom would make either be able to hang vertically, but a good distance from the bottom, this is what I asked you about. You know, remember we talked about doing this experiment on 80 meters, and you said you were the guy that had the perfect way of trying this, you said, because you have a pulley somewhere up the tower that could easily pull this thing up, thinking that that would be the, that would be actually the experiment that would answer this question, over.
It sure would. And I was out there when I'm mowing the lawn. This
repeater.
They're doing some experimenting with the repeater. While I was out there mowing the lawn today, I'm looking up periodically at the tower, looking at this yellow polypropylene rope going up to the top, going to the pulley, and the rope is bent over the pulley, and both ends come down and are tied to a tree, oh, about 30 feet off to one side of the tower. It is sitting there ready for a dipole to be raised in the air and be fed. I've got a couple of other projects I got to get out from under, and I can't do that experiment right now. But the raw ingredients of that experiment are sitting in my backyard, and it's bugging the daylights out of me. Now, if you ever visit my QTH and you see that, you're going to say, wow, that is ready to roll. And I'm not much of an HF man, but if I make a pure vertical antenna or a sloper, and it works half as well as you guys are telling me, maybe I'm going to become an 80-meter DX, or who knows. The guys on the microwave frequencies will, uh-oh, we lost another one. Well, not
okay.
Not that easy. A guy who's died in the world microwave, you can't be away from it very long, and you start getting withdrawal symptoms. Take my word for it. Okay, on the subject of antennas, which is always a beauty, let's make sure we have exhausted everyone's comments and questions on this one before we go over to Joe's question, and maybe Joe's got another antenna question, but let's make sure we have exhausted this one for the time being. If you've got any strong feelings and any more comments you want to make, give us your call letters right now. K2LIW and Mel in the TechNet. Okay. For the time being, they're done. So, Joe, go ahead and open up your subject. W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Yeah, I do have a question on relative to antennas. And the guy with the ACC controller, you've been blocking the net a couple times with your control functions. It's not very polite.
Okay, you're sounding good, Joe, so go right ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, well, I have a question, a comment on the subject last week, and then a space question, but I'm not sure how much time I'm going to have for all these things. All right, the question is, if you have this is all the questions dealing with antennas on UHF, which is up your line of work, which you use. You give a situation, we have a UHF vertical antenna called a station master, and you have a vertically polarized beam mounted just below that antenna. There is some sort of isolation between the antenna and the beam. I don't know exactly how much it is. The question is, if you increase the spacing by a factor of 5 feet from then having it right on top of each other, how much more would that buy you in isolation? A lot or a little? Or do you have any way of calculating that kind of answer out, Dick?
Okay. There's two or three pieces of information I can give you that'll help you on this. You're not going to get an exact answer out of this, Joe, but I'm going to give you a couple of pieces of information. When you mount two antennas like you're describing, a vertically polarized Yagi below a station master, first of all, the station master has a particular antenna pattern. And if you can see that pattern in three-dimensional space, it's kind of a fat pancake, where the maximum signal hopefully is going out to the horizon. Down in the direction where your Yagi is, hopefully the pattern has a pretty good null. And that's going to help you a lot when it comes to the isolation. By the same token, the vertically polarized Yagi has got a great big cucumber pattern in space, aimed in the foresight direction. And in theory, the front-to-side ratio is going to help you a whole lot. It's got very little radiation straight up from the antenna where the station master is. So just the two individual patterns are going to give you a lot of isolation. If I calculated how much isolation I get from the station master pattern down in the direction where the Yagi is, I might come up with an idea of, it's a 15 dB down in that direction. The Yagi has a front-to-side ratio, which maybe is another 15 dB, so you start off with around 30, and then you've got some inverse square law because there's some distance between the two. And then maybe the inverse square law is going to give you another 20 dB, and maybe you'll end up with 50 decibels of isolation between the two due to separation and individual patterns. That's the good news. There's a catch. And that is, those antenna patterns exist only if you're in the far field of the antenna, 2D squared of a lambda. You take the maximum dimension of the antenna, call it D, and in the same system of units, you take D squared, multiply by 2, divide by wavelength, in that same system of units, that's the so-called near field range. At that range, if you are measuring the antenna pattern of the antenna, you get the real pattern. When you move closer and closer from that range, the pattern starts degrading. The main lobe gets broader. The nulls between the main lobe and the side lobe get less deep. The side lobes tend to get stronger. Because your individual antennas are in the near field of each other, and therefore they've got a slightly different pattern, the number I just came up with, 50, you're going to find out is optimistic. It's probably more like 35. But it's there. Pattern is helping you, but you're in the near field, so you don't get quite the same pattern. And if you want to do a real good science experiment, you could go at that exact distance and measure the patterns of each of those antennas in that direction. And that would give you an exact answer. And then the inverse square law between the two, which can be calculated. 36 dB plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. F is megacycles and D is miles. And you're talking about feet, and yeah, you can calculate feet in a fraction of a mile.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
5.2 feet is 1/1000th of a mile, so to speak, 5.28 feet. So, and you can plug that into the formula, and the pluses and minuses all come out right. So that's one way you can do it. My gut feel is that if you're starting off with, I'm going to pick a number, 3 feet of separation between the top element of the 2-meter Yagi and the bottom element of the station master, and you take that 3 feet of separation and you make a 6 foot of separation, I think you're going to pick up another 5 or 8 dB of isolation. But if you've done a good job in the way you've mounted them, you should start off with something like 20 or more decibels of isolation between them to begin with. I presume the main reason you're asking this question, Joe, is you'd like to be able to transmit out of one antenna and receive out of the other antenna simultaneously, run full duplex, and not have the receiver being jammed. And it may require some attenuation in front of the receiver, but possibly you're doing a full duplex experiment. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing. And I've given you some very rough approximations, but I've told you some of the variables involved, and now you know a little bit more about what you're experimenting with. From A2LYY, K2LIW on the deck pad.
Okay, the antenna is used for UHF repeater and a link that's attached to it. It doesn't have to be mine, because I'm not doing something like that specifically, but the problem is the guy has the link antenna being operated about 12, 13, 14 megahertz away from the repeater receive frequency. The problem is when the link comes up, because the receiver is commanding the link to come up and take information from the repeater and transmit it elsewhere and vice versa, that's starting to bother his receiver preamp. He's starting to overload it by putting too much energy. It's getting down the coming down the antenna through the duplexer and the preamp is starting to overload it. He turns the link radio off, the descent seems to go away. He happened to map, this particular guy happened to map the antennas very, very close to each other. The beam is just below the radials, just slightly below the radials of the station master. The antennas, but the radio timed out. The antenna is a 5 dB gain antenna, so it's not one of these big, huge 20 footers. It's about an 8 footer that has 5 dB gain. So he was asking if he could move it 5 or 6 feet away, and I said, I don't really know what kind of isolation you're going to buy in addition to what you have already. And I said, the only way I would know how to even, I wouldn't even know how to calculate the isolation between one thing to another. I would simply do it with a piece of test equipment, put a signal in one antenna and receive it on the other, and hopefully you can get some sort of idea of what your isolation is that way. Moving it 5 or 6 feet away from one to the other, I don't know how much more that's going to really buy. So I guess if you said it gives you another 5 or 6 dB for that couple of feet distance, that's all he's going to have, because he can't put more separation than 5 or 6 dB between the two antennas totally.
Very fine, Joe. You said some magic words, 13 megacycles of separation between the receive frequency of the repeater and the link frequency of its transmitter or what it's receiving, whatever. If there's 13 megs of separation between the offending signal transmitter and the offending receiver, that's more than enough for you to build a notch filter. If you made a coaxial stub notch filter with one or two stubs, and the stub itself, because you've only got a small amount of frequency separation percentage-wise, 13 megs on, say, for instance, 2 meters is a 10%, yeah, I think it's a 10% separation. So therefore, your stub is probably going to be not a quarter wave long, but 5 quarter waves, 7 quarter waves, 9 quarter waves, so that you get a sharper stub action. But with the stub made out of the right kind of materials, you can create a notch in the frequency domain on the transmit frequency to that core receiver that's being overloaded, and you have to make sure that that preamp, by the way, is very well shielded. Many a preamp, like the AR squared, Advanced Receiver Research, makes a beautiful preamp, but you put that preamp inside of a repeater system without building a box around it, and you're asking for trouble, because no matter how many conversations I've had with the people who build that beautiful product, they don't know how to build a real electromagnetic interference shield. That box that it's in with the paint that's underneath the cover and a couple of screws that are holding it down, that is not a well-shielded box from the viewpoint of a repeater operation where you want everything shielded to the nearest 130 dB. I think that box is shielded by 80 dB, not 130. So as long as your preamp is well-shielded and the B-plus wiring to it is well-shielded, then the next step is I would put in a stub filter, a notch filter, and with that notch, you can now get easily 30 dB of rejection of the offending signal. That's with one stub, and if you build a pair of stubs, you could get 60 dB of rejection. So you've got that 13 megs is a beautiful advantage. You can use it for stop band filtering, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW in the tech band.
Okay, I'm not going to exhaust funding with anyone further than that. He's going to have to try with some vertical separation for the antennas and see how much more that buys, or if it cures his problem, minimizes his problem, or whatever. That's fine. That's as far as that goes. The other question was, as far as your question was, I asked you last week about testing RF cables if they had water or moisture, and you said water was a very absorbent thing on 450 and 2 meters and 450. And you said even having a reading of 10 meg across a line with some water contamination or even higher would be enough to give you plenty of absorption, or even to the point where you could even measure it. You said you only measure up to 10 meg. Is there a point where you wouldn't see any interaction anymore if you had an additional meter of the cable going up to, say, 30 meg, and you saw not even 30 megabyte of resistance right here, or it showed like, you know, 30 or more? Do you still think that would be a problem with being contaminated?
Yeah, I see the nature of what you're asking here, Joe. And the answer is yes and no, and I'm going to give you both answers. In the system that I had with my 16 Yagi array of 19 element Yagis on 432 on 100 feet of power from 1984, that, or 85, that Hurricane Gloria yanked that off my tower for me. It was all fed with a phasing harness with FM8 cable. FM8 is times wiring cable, I think it was, for ITT. I think ITT is a manufacturer of FM8. It is a flexible braided cable with foam as the dielectric. The majority of the water that I was getting was coming into the type N connectors. I had a total of 32 type N connectors with all the power dividing to all of those 16 Yagis and the relays and everything else that was up there. If water got into any one of those connectors, because all of the center conductors of all of the driven elements of all those Yagis were floating, by putting an ohmmeter between center conductor and shield of the transmission line and the shack, I could find out if water was in any one of those connectors. Let me drop. When the whole system was dry, I would measure multiple megohms between center conductor and shield. As I started coming down to half a megohm or below, I know that the amount of water sitting in a connector was giving me significant loss, and it was time to go up there and do a repair. Find out which connector was leaking, take it apart, dry it out, do a better job of weatherproofing it. However, very slowly over the 4 or 5 years that that antenna was operational, I was getting a slow creepage of water into the outer layers of the foam right underneath the braid of those cables. I found it out because when Hurricane Gloria removed that antenna from my tower, and also when I looked at my records over the 4 years I was running schedules with K4CAW, I noticed that there was a slow degradation taking place over that four-year period that he and I were running those skids over that 480-mile path between me and Greensboro, North Carolina, on 432 sideband. Slow degradation was taking place. That did not show up at the ohmmeter. Near the end of that four-year period, when I was running those skids within 4.5 years, I could make sure every one of the connectors were clean, the megohms measured multiple megohms. I thought I had a great system. Hurricane Gloria yanked the antenna down for me. I decided to re-measure the phasing harness. I found out the dBs of insertion loss at every darn one of those foam-filled FM8 cables had doubled or tripled in decibels. So water had slowly crawled into the outer layers of foam of the dielectric, because your outer polyethylene jacket looks like a beautiful weather seal. It's sort of a weather seal. It is not a hermetic seal. Water vapor very slowly migrates through that outer polyethylene jacket, slowly migrates into that foam. The water that was deposited into those little cells of the foam, even though they're closed cells, the water slowly migrated into there, doubled and tripled the insertion loss of that cable in decibels. So, in other words, not even my ohm meter would tell it to me. A time domain reflectometer would not tell it to me. The only way I could have found out is if I had chosen one of those Yagis and measured the power transfer from the shack to that Yagi, would I rediscover the extra loss. That experience has told me I will never again, for the rest of my life, use braided foam-filled cable outside of my shack. Every piece of foam-filled cable from now on is going to be hardline with well-sealed connectors on the end. I have zero faith in braided foam-filled cable at UHF frequencies because of that experience. All of those 16 pieces of cable of the phasing harness, every single one of them increased 2 or 3 times the number of decibels of when they were originally installed. At first I thought something was wrong with my equipment and went and got a fresh piece of cable out of the cellar from the exact same roll, and I could easily see the difference of insertion loss. I think you see what we're working on here, repeater.
Right on. Repeater. Huh? timeout. Cancel.
I think you can see what we're working on here, Joe. It's a very insidious problem. I will never again at UHF frequencies and VHF frequencies use braided, foam-filled, flexible cable outside of my house. Come E2RYY, K2RYW.
E2KY with a comment.
Mel recognized. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, my reason for asking was more of a sort of like a work-related type of a question. If you were using, you know, certain test equipment and checking somebody else's equipment, and you were able to open up the transmission line and say, okay, I don't even see 30 megs across the line. I see nothing. I show infinity. Because in some cases, it's very hard for equipment up there to be able to do an end-to-end RF test in decibels across the line. It's very hard to do that in some cases. That's why I'm asking this question about the integrity of the line by being able to measure, water contamination or conductance or some sort of conductance across the line. That's what I'm basically getting at with this whole question.
Yeah, and under ordinary circumstances, I'd say put a short or an open at the end and look at reverse reflective power and measure this one. In the case of lossy water distributed evenly through the foam, but not bridging the gap between semiconductor and ground, your ohm meter won't show it, your TDR won't show it, the reflective power ratio won't show it, because the signal is being attenuated by the water on the way up to the open circuit or the short circuit, and then attenuated on the reflective signal coming back down. You'll get a wait a minute, let me think about that. I will, with a shorter open test, be able to measure total insertion loss. That's all I really care about. So, you don't have to bring instrumentation up there. Just create a short or an open up there by way of a relay or demanding that the rigger simply open up the piece of cable. In the case of the 716 DIN connector at your frequencies, it's going to radiate like a banshee. He's got to put a short circuit on the end. You put the short circuit on the end, you measure the apparent standing wave ratio in the shack, you now know the insertion loss of that cable. And you now have tested for everything except water bridging the gap at the point where he put the short circuit. That's the one place where you wouldn't know it. The water in that exact connector that you're short-circuiting, the short circuit's going to dominate. So when he opens it up and you measure infinite number of ohms, and he puts the short circuit and you measure the right visor in the shack, which tells you the insertion loss of the cable, you've now confirmed that cable without bringing instrumentation up there. All he's got to do is bring a short circuit. I'm going to send it back to you, Joe, after Mel, see what Mel's going to say on this. K2KUY, K2LIW.
Okay. Today I went to the handset that Limart had. Now, yeah, and I just have been walking around, and one guy had on the table, he had like 50-foot length, 100-foot length of RG8U. I didn't particularly pay a heck of a lot of attention. Only what caught my eye is these cables were already made up with connectors on the end. He had one with both PL59 on each end. He had one with an N connector on one end or a PL59 the opposite end. You know, a number of different versions of that. And when I went to, you know, just pick it up just to examine one of the pieces of cable, that cable was, you know, sitting in the sun. The sun was blazing hot there today. It was really a beautiful day back there. Perfect day for a ham fest. That cable was hot. I mean, you know, not to the point of I'll burn my hand, I'd say. I was curious. Do you think that the cable sitting in the sun day in and day out, don't you think, would that have any effect in drying up the cable to somewhat of moisture had migrated into a thick over?
Yeah, I wish. That foam-filled, black, hot cable called FM8 that I had on my tower did not dry out. All 16 of those phasing harnesses going to each antenna had this excess insertion loss. The nasty thing about water, Mel, is that on a hot day, all the air in the foam and in the cable is all expanded. Along comes a rain shower, and now you get cold water touching hot cable, and boy, it sucks in water like you wouldn't believe. I think the water evaporates out in about a one-year period of time, but it gets sucked in on every rainstorm every single week. Water in foam-filled cable is nasty stuff. You want the humidity of the water inside the foam-filled cable to be 1% humidity. You and I live near a seashore, and our environment is a 50 or 60% humidity all the time. And so foam-filled, flexible cable with braid on the outside, without some kind of a inner foil that is hermetically sealed, in my opinion, we're in trouble. I have never seen any experiment of where somebody put flexible foam-filled cable with an ordinary braid on the outside, outdoors for a four-year period of time, and had it not significantly increase in insertion loss because of more migration of water vapor. That's my opinion on this one, Mel. And as such, I am a strong advocate of hardline. I don't care if it's 70-ohm hardline and you got a 50-ohm system. The fact that it's hardline and you got to do a good job of sealing the connectors, you stand a chance of keeping out the water. I think you see where I'm going on this one. Back to you, Mel, for any comments on that one.
Oh, I can only tell you, I've got a lot of that 99.14 because I got it right at the right price. So I got a lot of right, a lot of 99.14. And they have basically, like you say, they wrap it with that aluminum very, very tight. And I have pieces that I've, you know, cut open. I change, always change the cables and things. And I found that inside as clean as possible. So maybe that's the answer, that they wrap it first with that aluminum, you know, very tight, thin layer of aluminum, and then they put the braid over it. And according to what they've been saying in Belden, because, oh, I don't want to get into that thing that I had with Belden, when I mentioned to him about the 99-13 and water migration problem, all, the guy almost, I thought it was going to jump through the phone, the guy, our, the person we dealt with, you know, where we procured the cables from the Belden. He was like, the guy took the order, engineered, and, oh, a whole bunch of things. He was quite a character to talk to, but very, he was nice to me. But when I mentioned anything about water or anything in the cables, oh, he almost went crazy. The test they do, this and that, they said, oh. And supposedly the 99-14, they have cured that problem, Dick. I can say I know working with hardline is a problem, over.
And I think you're right. 99-13, I believe, was a bit of a disaster of a cable. I think the later versions of 99-14 have an aluminum wrap that's at the same altitude as the braid, the same diameter as the braid. I think it's inside the braid. And I think that aluminum is not just wrapped tight. I think it's a continuous tube of aluminum foil in there, which is a hermetic seal. So I have reason to believe that the 99-14 has solved that problem, and it may be one of the few cables that is a foam-filled, flexible cable that doesn't have water migration problem. When you open it up and look with your eye, the fact that it looks clean, Mel, may not be good enough. When I opened up my FM8 cable and looked inside, the foam looked clean. I'll admit that the center conductor looked tarnished, and that was a clue that some kind of water migration or whatever had taken place. Center conductor looked tarnished of the cable, but the foam itself looked clean. You can get water vapor migrating into those cells of the foam, and unless you're doing a very high microscope magnification, I don't think you're going to see evidence of the water. In fact, it might be a vapor that might not even show up on a microscope. So visual inspection of the foam might not be good enough. I think the only real acid test is something that measures insertion loss end-to-end at your favorite frequency. That's my belief on this one. And I hope the 99-14 has solved it. It sounds like they have. And a buddy of mine has installed some 99-14 on my tower, and that particular cable is working quite well. Joe, I think you had some further questions or comments. W-A-2-R-Y-1,
K-2-R-I-W. Joe, I do have a quick question.
Glenn recognized, Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, enough ringing these two RF questions out for a while. I may have some more thoughts about it next week or whatever, or other questions. The last thing I had was a question, a space question, specifically a space a shuttle question. I happen to see a diagram, or actually a cutaway view of the external fuel tank. And I never realized how they construct the thing inside, but what I did happen to see is that they put the locks on the bottom and the liquid hydrogen on the top. Is that simply because the liquid oxygen is heavier with the same cubic feet of area compared to the hydrogen? And is that used for balance to keep the weight at the bottom?
Yeah, Don, good question as to why they chose top and bottom. like that. I think the density of the liquid hydrogen is slightly lower than the liquid oxygen. You and I can look that up on Google. We can find that out real fast. Also, the volume of the hydrogen and the volume of the oxygen is not equal to each other. So there's a combination of which tank is bigger, which tank is lighter, where they want the center of gravity, how you're going to arrange the barrier between the tanks, which one runs at a higher temperature or a lower temperature. Do you want the higher temperature boil-off material? I am guessing that liquid hydrogen boils off at a lower temperature than the liquid oxygen, but I'm not positive on that one. So boil-off temperature, which is the temperature that the tank is running when you've got it sitting on the pad, so it's a combination of mass, volume, and temperature. Some combination of that went into the choice of which tank's on top, which tank's on the bottom. Good question. And you got my curiosity going on that one, Joe. I'm going to look into it. Glenn, I said earlier that your audio is good and loud. It could be a little louder, in my opinion. And again, when you go to amateurradio.tv and listen to yourself, you can also judge as to whether or not your audio was loud enough. Get close to the mic there, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQRIW in the second half.
Okay, I'm a little bit closer to the mic now. Is this a little bit better?
Yes, it is. I think what's going on is this particular repeater, the gain is set very slightly low, in my opinion, whereas the gain to the repeater that that Bell uses is a Kings County Radio Club repeater. They complain that he's too loud. That particular repeater must have a higher gain. So this one, I think, is set a little bit on the low side, is my opinion. So you can use every bit of volume you've given us so far, Glenn. Go ahead.
Okay. The question I had was, on the coax that you had that was outside, apparently it's water that's seeping into the foam that's causing the additional high-frequency loss. I guess my question is, if you allowed the cable to dry out, did the insertion loss that you see come back to regular insertion loss, or was that basically like a damage to the cable that just couldn't be repaired?
Don, good question, Glenn. I didn't run that experiment. And it's not water getting into the cable, it's water vapor. Water vapor is an extremely small molecule that can get everywhere. And water vapor is a strange material. Common sense would lead you to believe that ordinary air has a certain capacity to absorb water. And you and I call that relative humidity. And when the humidity gets real high, we say, boy, that air is heavy. Wow, I feel uncomfortable. If you're an aircraft pilot and you're going to take off from Denver on a nice dry day and you're going to fly into Louisiana on a nice moist day, you would assume that the heavy air with a lot of water vapor in Louisiana would be a much better material to fly through. It's the exact opposite. If you measure pounds per cubic foot of mass of air, the higher the humidity, the lower the density of the air. I'm not sure now, is the water at? The water vapor is displacing your oxygen and nitrogen molecules as part of it, and the water vapor is a lighter substance. Therefore, it takes more runway distance to take off on a high humidity day than a low humidity day. Pilots have found this out very painfully. Some of them have died in the process of finding it out. So water vapor is a weird substance, and it can get into places like you wouldn't believe. When it comes to mil-spec hardware and hermeticity sealing, in other words, really good sealing so that water vapor doesn't get into your delicate integrated circuit and give you purple plague and all these other nasty things that can happen to your little exposed wafer inside of your package. Let me drop. That hermeticity test takes the smallest molecule that mankind has ever seen, a helium molecule. You put your device of the test inside of a chamber, which has got a high percentage of helium under high pressure. You leave it there for a given length of time. You take your device of the test out of that chamber. You put it into a second chamber where it's got instrumentation that measures one molecule at a time that boils off from the inside of your device of the test. It's a helium leak test. And that's the way you measure hermeticity, because if you fail the helium leak test, which is the smallest molecule that ever existed, and you would say, how in the world can helium be a smaller molecule than hydrogen? Well, the helium molecule has got two protons in the center. It's got a stronger electrostatic field in the center, therefore the electrons going around it are packed in closer in that orbit. It is a smaller molecule. And so when you fail the helium leak test, even though the water vapor molecule is a much bigger molecule, all you're measuring is the rate at which you're going to get the damage. If you fail the helium leak test in a half hour, maybe it's going to take 2 weeks for you to fail the humidity test, but you're going to fail it. So hermeticity, true sealing, so that nothing gets into your delicate circuit, whether it be your integrated circuit inside of a hermetically sealed package, or whether it be your delicate folds inside of a cable. That water vapor can get through anything other than a welded metal-to-metal seal or a perfect glass seal. Other than that, water vapor will go through everything you've ever seen. Every rubber seal you've ever seen has a certain rate at which water vapor will migrate through that rubber seal. To me, that was a shocker when I found that one out. Back to you, Glenn. K2LIW in the deck, man.
Yes, it's really an interesting phenomenon. I noticed that I've had cables over the years that certainly the insertion list definitely goes up on them, and certainly as the frequency goes up, it's nasty. On anything that's 2 meters, almost never have I been able to get away with a cable more than like 2 years before. It's just, it's a noticeable problem. And, I'm using the LMR 400 right now, and it's just about that three and a half year mark, but it seems to be holding in. I'm moving my antennas around. I just put up a small mini tower, but I think you just have, I'm going to probably get a break out the old network analyzer and just check it just for grins and giggles, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Dick. Thanks again.
Yeah, it would be an interesting experiment to find out what's required to restore my FM8 cables with double or triple the insertion loss in decibels at 432 megs. What would it take to restore them? If I bake them in an oven at a high enough temperature to boil off the water vapor, but a low enough temperature that didn't damage the foam, I think that would make an improvement. It's a slightly dangerous experiment to do. If I put it in a vacuum chamber for a week, I'm pretty sure the water vapor would boil off. But if I just simply left the cable in the living room of my house, so to speak, with all the other stuff I've got in the living room of my house, that's another joke, and I waited until it dried out, with my house running at 60% humidity, when my children are with me and they took a shower every hour and they're doing cooking and whatever, doing all kinds of things to increase the humidity of the house, it is my guess that the cable would never come back to normal, would never get a chance to dry out. I'd have to do something very aggressive, like putting it into a vacuum chamber or baking it at a higher temperature. And even after I did that, if I then put that cable back outside, I guarantee within a hell of a lot less than 4.5 years of the first experiment, I'd be back to high insertion loss. The bottom line is, I'm never going to use simply braided foam-filled cable without some kind of a metal shield on that cable. I'll never use that again. All of my flexible cables that go around my rotators on my towers are all RG214, RG9, double-shielded polyethylene jacket. The nice thing about polyethylene, although it's got a little bit more insertion loss, and the good news is I'm not using very many feet of it just to go around the rotator, the polyethylene has very little ability to absorb water. But foam-filled cable, wow, can it absorb water. The next person who signed in had a yes question. Could have been Bill, KGZ. Let's see if he's there. To be to Quebec Golf Zulu, if you have something to say or ask, Bill, go right ahead, K2LIW in the deck, man. Hello? Okay, maybe Bill was just signing in to let us know he was there. Steve, I think he said a no, but I'm going to give him another chance. KC2, Mike Delta Papa. Steve, do you want to contribute or ask something? You got a chance right now. You got it, Steve.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I did have a question. Good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else out on the net, KC2FDP. Dick, my question is, basically I have two scanner receivers that I want to connect to a common antenna, basically just using, a couple of simple T connectors and a couple of coax jumpers. Will this work without any significant loss of signal, or should I go with a separate antenna for each scanner receiver? Back to you, Dick.
I've got pretty much good news for you, Steve. A receiver is an amazingly forgiving device, and I'll tell you why. Most receivers will go down to something like a quarter of a microvolt if it's a good receiver, quarter of a microvolt of sensitivity. If you had a single antenna feed line coming to a T connector, and now two separate 50 ohm cables going from the T connector to scanner number one and scanner number two. Assuming the scanners had a 50 ohm input of field, they don't, but we won't go there. Just the fact that you've got a pair of 50 ohm cables means that you have created at the center of that T connector, you have created a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. An uncompensated T with two cables coming out and one going in does that. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, in theory, worst case, creates half a dB of insertion loss. For all of the things you listen to with your scanner, because there were two scanners there and a T connector versus one cable going into one scanner, the fact that both of the scanners have, in theory, signals that are half a dB weaker, and most of the things you listen to are 20 dB out of the noise, you would never know the difference. A receiver is amazingly forgiving. On top of that, many receivers have an input impedance that's even higher than 50 ohms. So therefore, what happens at the center of the T connector is nowhere near as bad as a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. You could, if you want to, find out the exact input impedance of your particular scanner. It might be 150 ohms. Choose the right length of the right cable so that at the center of the T connector, it comes out to a pair of 100 ohm resistors that are in parallel, and now everything is thoroughly matched. You might even come out ahead using the T connector as opposed to bringing the transmission line straight to the scanner. So receivers are amazingly forgiving. You can take an HF receiver and take nothing but a 3-foot long clip lead, connect it to the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back of the receiver. The S meter won't move quite as far, but the signal to noise ratio of almost every signal you hear on the band will be about the same. As I said, receivers are very forgiving. Transmit through that clip lead and you're wasting your time. No one's going to hear you except the guy next door. But receiving, you can get away with murder. So if you want to be a purist, you can use some kind of an exact impedance match power divider. I don't think you got to. I think you could put four receivers in parallel. The only thing you'd have to worry about a little bit is that if receiver number one happens to be of a design where a fair amount of its local oscillator signal comes roaring out of that connector and it goes into the other receivers, it could give you a little bit of cross-coupling characteristic at certain frequency combinations. Certain frequency combinations, the LO of one might interfere with the reception of the other. But other than that, I think you could put four receivers in parallel and make it work.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So give it a try. Nothing bad's going to happen. It ain't going to explode, and we'll catch on fire. KC2MDB, K2RIW in the tech man.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'll have to go through my junk drawer and look for a couple of connectors and some cable. I just got to find all this good stuff. Once again, I thank you for your answer.
And you're going, if I know you, Steve, you're enough of a scientist, you're going to do an AD test. In other words, you're going to bring the cable straight into scanner number one, then you're going to bring the cable straight into scanner number two, then you're going to hook up both scanners at the same time with the T connector, and you're going to evaluate the results. Whether it be good news or bad news or a tenth of a dB of loss or half a dB of loss, please come back and tell us what you find. We're giving you a homework assignment, Steve, and you're promising to report back to us. Isn't that right, Steve? Okay, Steve first.
Yeah, no problem, Dick. I'll play with this tomorrow, probably, and next week I'll let you know what happened.
Very good. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick note on the same topic. One time I was doing the experiments but the opposite way around, using one scanner, but it's multiple antennas and teaming together, which I thought would probably work similar, but unfortunately what I had was the highest frequency antenna with a short circuit to lower frequencies below it, and because they weren't capacitively coupled, it tends to short out the other frequencies, so it doesn't necessarily work the other way around with the antennas.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. If you and I studied a station master antenna, for instance, the biggest problem a station master runs into is lightning. Therefore, they make sure there is a DC ground between center conductor and shield of that antenna, whether it's done throughout the actual elements of the antenna itself, and the last one at the top is a short circuit center conductor to shield, or whether or not there's an artichoke at the bottom. Most VHF antennas that are going to go on top of a tower, they try to create a DC ground, and therefore you put that VHF antenna in parallel with almost any HF antenna, and the VHF short circuit is a really good short circuit at HF frequencies, and it's going to really kill the HF antenna. That's sort of predictable. There's a couple of exceptions to that. There is the possibility of building a VHF antenna in such a way that inside the antenna it is a short circuit, but then you could, if you want to, add a coupling capacitor on the output of that antenna going to the center conductor of the cable. And you choose the right size capacitor so it's got the, well, let's say 5 ohms of reactance at your VHF frequency. But now, because the HF is so many octaves lower, it might be a 5,000 ohm capacitor reactance at the HF frequency, and you could make it work. And the next step beyond that would be to build a real diplexing filter. Build a filter that passes the HF signal from the common connector to output port number 1, and it passes the VHF frequency through filter number 2 to output connector number 2. You could build a diplexing filter that makes all that work just right. So that would be the elegant approach. And because there's so many octaves of difference between HF and VHF, that could be an extremely simple filter. It's something you could probably build in a mini box. Not many guys have got the nerve to go and build that kind of a thing, but once you get beyond the fear factor, I bet it's quite easy. I bet you Mel has done things like that. Let's find out. K2KEY, K2LIW.
W2CDO. Hello.
Andy recognized Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Did all kinds of experiments like that. But, pick up Andy first. I got to take care of one thing, Dick.
Okay. Hey, Andy. How's the machine doing? How you doing? W2CDO, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. I've been listening in a little bit. As I watch the lightning in the distance, I wonder if you're getting any storms. It looks like it's to the east of me. So, there's something going on. Dick, I just wanted to mention, a couple of things. We're talking about coax cable, migration of water, and so on. It turns out that our landlord, who provides us all these sites, has been using hardline for many years, and multiple lengths of it. It turns out that he prefers, over all the hardline companies out there, he prefers the Andrews LDS series over Times Wire. And I believe one of the reasons is just what you were talking about, because I know that he periodically changes his feed lines throughout his towers from bottom to top every few years. And in comparing the two, I want to find out more information on what he feels about it. That Andrews is much more superior to Times Wire, Times Cable, as far as hardline is concerned. I wanted to bring that up and mention that. I'll be right back. I just have a quick phone call I got to grab. But go ahead, Dick.
Good information, Andy. Yeah, to be on the safe side, to be a double-don sure, belt and suspenders type person, even with a quality brand of cable, if it's a high-priority communication system, some people will replace the cable every X number of years on the tower. Andrew, by the way, is the biggest manufacturer of both coaxial cable and amplifiers in the United States, if not the world. And it's not Andrews, plural, it's Andrew, A-N-D-R-E-W. Lots of people call it Andrews, but it's Andrew. It's a singular Andrew is the brand name. And they make a rather high quality product that a lot of people use. Andy and his work experience is using a lot of Andrew cable strung throughout those places in New York City that he works at. It is my belief that if you do a real good job of sealing the ends where the connector is applied to Andrew Hardline cable. I think the possibility exists that the cable could give you very high performance for at least 10 or 15 years. Put the cable in a high vibration environment. Don't do a good job of weather sealing it. Do a sloppy job of installing the connector, and you could be in trouble within 6 months. So pilot error is, I think, the only determining factor as to whether or not the cable is going to have high survivability in your particular environment. That, combined with how severe is the environment. If you're putting it mounted on the side of a Jeep, and you're going to be driving through the woods and vibrating the living daylights out of it, yeah, maybe you're going to want to replace it every 6 months or so. But if the cable is well attached to a tower and not flapping in the breeze, and the ends are properly installed and weatherproof, I have used hardline cable for, I think, some of my older pieces of cable. Provolin is the brand name of one of my pieces of 3/4 inch hardline. Is it 3/4 inch or is it 1/4? I think it's 3/4 inch. And I've got a piece of Provolin cable that's up there since 1975. Let me think that. 35. That is 33 years. One of my Provolin pieces of cable going to a 432 antenna has given me no problems in 32 years of use. And that particular run is about 110 feet long, and it was done with a pair of 60-foot pieces of Provolin. That's what I was able to buy at the time on the surplus market. Let me drop. And it's got a union connector in between the two pieces. So it's a pair of 60-foot lengths of Provolin air-filled cable, which is supposed to be pressurized. And mine is not pressurized. Again, I pushed my luck a little bit and got away with it. And from all I can tell, it's giving me reasonably low insertion loss at 432, 32 years later. That's air-filled hardline cable. Let's see if Andy is back from his phone call. The A2CDL, K2LIW in the VicNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I'm back. Yeah, and I heard what you said. And it is Andrew. I always call it Andrews. Okay. Yeah, very good. I unfortunately missed some of what you said, but even though I'm back here, and I have to sign out because I got to take another call here. You may be in for a storm, to let you know, because I see quite a bit of lightning to the east of me in your direction. I'm going to have to run because I got to take care of some stuff here. Dick, thanks. I'll get back to you and discuss some other things that we want to talk about that we haven't had a chance to yet. Bessel functions and FM modulation and even a question regarding a PI network of a tube amplifier and some problems with those that have come across. But I'm going to have to run. Thanks, Dick. I'll keep you posted. W8CDM.
6W2EWK for a comment. I think I solved your problem. Okay.
Okay, stand by, Bay Eugene. Andy, the ball is in your court. Mel and I here every week. We're ready to start discussing your PI network, your Bessel functions, and whatever. We think we can add some light to that subject. So, as I said, the ball's in your court. We're here. You're just going to have to schedule a chunk of time. I'm looking at a weather map right now that is 5 minutes old, and I do see a storm that is south of Long Island. Looks to me like it's about 10 miles south of the South Shore, roughly at the Nassau-Suffolk border, and it's moving to the east. I'm looking at an animation. So right now, my weather map leads me to believe that there may be local lightning to you, but it ain't getting to me right now, and I see no evidence of it. W2EWK, go ahead with your comment, Eugene. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, my comment is W2EWK. You know, Dick, I like to take things apart. I like to see how things work. And sometimes I do not put them back to they used to be before. Okay? That's the reason I get in trouble all the time, because I take things apart. I like to be like a scientist all the time. Well, Dick, let me tell you something. I went to my local windows on cars. You know, they don't clean windows. They put windows into cars, and they get this gooey stuff. You know, it's black. And they put the stuff inside the window and keep it from, you know, vibrating. So I get that stuff over here, and I put that stuff on my PL-259, and it seems to hold up very well, and no water has gone into my coax cable for God only knows. It must has to be over 10 years old, but it's really holding up real good. And before I put the gooey stuff on, I take black tape, brand new black tape, I wrap it 1,000 times over, then I put the black stuff onto it, and seems to be doing a real good job, W2EWK.
You're very right, Eugene. That black stuff that they use for sealing windshields on automobiles, very effective weatherproofing material, not hermetic seal material, but weatherproofing material. And the rate at which water vapor will migrate through that material is very, very slow. When you go to Radio Shack or any other good store where you can buy the stuff called coax seal, it is essentially the same stuff. Coax seal is in a nice package and it's in nice strips with little pieces of wax paper in between, and it's very convenient to separate. You can also go to Home Depot or Lowe's or any of these other stores and buy a material called duck seal. D-U-C-K, I think it is, seal. Duck seal material. It comes in a great big wedge, and you get a lot more of it per a lot more pounds of it per dollar than you do with coax seal. Again, the same stuff. And I often use that on my coax connectors outdoors very successfully. The biggest problem you have with outdoor connector is make sure there is no airspace under your wrapping material, because the airspace will be expanding, contracting on a hot and cold day. Therefore, it will be breathing, and it will act like a power piston, and it will force water in there. Because some of our connectors, let me drop, have a great big change in diameter. When you go to the end of the connector and where the cable begins, and you try to wrap tape in there, and you get an air gap under the tape, and any air gap will breathe, and will eventually act like a power piston and force water into other portions of the system. Therefore, if you pack the coax seal, the gooey stuff, on top of the cable connector first to seal out all air spaces, and then wrap tape on top of it, you get a much better weather seal. That's the good news. The bad news is if you've got to take that apart and the coax seal has hardened, I'll admit that removing it from the connector is a pain. You may have to slice it off with a Stanley knife, if you know what I mean. It is a pain to remove, but it gives you a better weather seal. A lot of guys will wrap the tape first and then put the coax seal on top of that, and that is a lot easier to remove, I'll admit. But if you're not real careful, and if you end up with an airspace inside, that airspace can give you a lot of trouble. That's what I've discovered when it comes to my 10-gig circuit, because one drop of water at 10 gigs will really kill the signal. You can't tolerate an airspace anywhere. Therefore, I live with the disadvantage of the coax seal directly on the connector and then tape on top of that. That's the way I do it. You have to make a decision. Is weather sealing more important, or ease of removing the weather sealing later more important? And there's a conflict of interest between those two approaches. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
And 2RSO.
K-E-Y.
And 2RSO, and then KEY in that order. Mr. RSO, start up with your name, sir, and then tell us your comment.
Okay, Dick, my name is Frank, and I think I've discovered the best of both worlds. Also available at Home Depot and or Lowe's. There's a product, one of which is manufactured by the Nashua company, Nashua Tape, and I believe there's another manufacturer. And you basically find it in the plumbing department, and it's a silicon-based tape that's used for wrapping around copper pipes or brass pipes that have a leak in them. And it's completely waterproof. And when you stretch it and put a seal around it, it really clogs it up and does a permanent fix on it. Well, I've been using that tape on a couple of my TL-259 connectors and find it not only very easy to use and making a very tight seal, but when you cover it with